The Klamath River is a soupy mess at the moment. It looks like pea soup in places, and unlike pea soup, it is not good for you, even to touch. Toxic blue-green algae is in bloom in many places along the river in both states. In fact, a warning on the Oregon side was lifted last week, only to be put back in place this week. Let's get a handle on what's going on with the Klamath and how this compares to historic algae blooms along the river and elsewhere in the region. Three guests join us. Rebecca Hillwig is with the Harmful Algal Bloom Surveillance Program with the Oregon Health Authority. Rebecca, thank you for joining us on The Exchange today.
Thanks for having me.
Susan Fricke is with us. She is with the Karuk Tribe as a water quality coordinator. Hi, Susan.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. And Craig Tucker joins us once again as well. He is a biologist for the Karuk Tribe. Hi, Craig.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Good to have you all here. So, Rebecca Hillwig, let's start with you. If you can give us the situation in the Oregon side of the Klamath River, because there was a warning that was in place, was lifted last week, and then put back in place just a couple of days ago.
Yeah, actually, the Klamath Basin is one of the areas in Oregon that gets a lot of monitoring completed, unlike a lot of other places in the state. And so we actually get a lot of data from different agencies and different groups, such as the Karuk Tribe. And so sometimes we get kind of bombarded with a lot more data than some of the data that we need to actually issue an advisory. So basically what happened on Monday was that the person who was actually analyzing the data was looking at that data that was collected farther downstream from the area under the advisory and mistakenly lifted the advisory. So we did have to reissue it based on further analysis of the actual data in the advisory area.
All right, so just a mistake in looking at where the samples were taken from was what led to the lifting in the first place?
Correct.
Is it possible, though, that the conditions have lessened a bit since the advisory first went into effect?
Yeah, it's it's hard to say because obviously we don't know what the bloom is doing unless sampling and analysis are done. But cooler weather does tend to reduce blooms and reduce the issue in the area. However, with the weather that we've been having, it's hard to say. I mean, it could be less, it could be worse. We really don't know until we get the data to actually see what the toxins or levels are at.
So as the weather cools, people can expect that the incidence will lessen?
Yeah, consistently cool. You know, this kind of up and down doesn't really do a whole lot, but, a consistently cool weather pattern would actually help, yes.
Susan Fricke with the Karuk Tribe Water Quality Coordinator. Give us a sense of what the situation is. I know the Karuk are one of several organizations on the California side that monitor the health of the Klamath River. How extensive are the warnings on the California side?
Well, right now we have had warnings that have been in effect since August, and the river is actually listed all the way from the reservoirs. That would be Copco and Iron Gate Reservoir and PacifiCorp's hydroelectric project, all the way down 190 miles down to the mouth of the river. And we have them listing for no contact for the water. The levels are severe enough right now that you shouldn't be swimming in it, the dogs shouldn't be in it. And there's actually a couple places on the river where the levels are high enough you really shouldn't be eating fish out of the water either, according to the California health guidelines.
All right, so really no contact at all with the water for humans and their animals anyway.
Correct.
All right, so and how unusual is this situation? I mean, how often does it happen that you'll get, as you pointed out, 197 miles, is it, of the river from dams all the way to the ocean?
Right. Normally we don't get a bloom that necessarily is this severe for the whole duration of the river, but we have had blooms like this before. I was looking back through the data, and we definitely did in 2009. We had some high bloom severities within the river, but it doesn't happen every year, and the length of the blooms can vary. Normally what we find if the river starts blooming like this is it will start in August, and it can go all the way through October. So as you guys were talking about earlier, even if you do have the fall cooling patterns, the algae can still be coming out of the reservoirs and going through the river, making it toxic for people and animals to be in the river.
Craig Tucker, you're the biologist. Let's talk about what that toxicity does. I mean, how can it affect people if they either ignore the warnings or aren't aware of them?
Well, the blue blue-green algae that blooms in the Klamath system, there's several varieties of algae, but the one that's problematic is called Microcystis aeruginosa. And it's problematic because this algae secretes a liver toxin called microcystin. And so exposing yourself to microcystin can cause a variety of health effects. Some of these health effects are things like skin rashes, nausea, and headaches. But over time, continued exposure to microcystin can cause a lot of liver problems and can cause liver failure. So it's actually quite a serious health threat for communities along the Klamath River. And for tribes, you know, this is, this time of year, in September in particular, is when tribal fishing typically happens. It's when annual world renewal ceremonies happen. And for ceremonial leaders, there's some obligation to ritualistically bathe in the Klamath River. And so in order to practice their religion, people are exposing themselves to this severe health threat. And it's quite a problem for tribal communities.
So they're not putting a hold on the religious ceremonies. Those are continuing despite the danger.
Well, folks in the ceremonial communities take their obligations very seriously. So I would presume that most of the leaders would probably carry out the religious obligations irrespective of these health warnings.
We are talking about the health warnings for the Klamath River. Pretty much all of the river on both sides of the state line affected by blue-green algae, which is toxic. Craig Tucker is a biologist for the Karuk Tribe. Susan Fricke, the water quality coordinator for the tribe. Rebecca Hillwig joins us from the Oregon Health Authority. She is in charge of the Harmful Algal Bloom Surveillance Program. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Rebecca, I failed to ask the extent of the warnings on the Oregon side. Is pretty much all of the, and it's the Klamath and Link rivers, I noticed, together.
Yeah, so the advisory, there's kind of three separate advisories just because they happened at different times. But basically, there is an advisory in place from Agency Lake, which includes Agency Lake, all the way down to the Keno Dam.
All right, so that's way at the upper end of Upper Klamath Lake,
correct.
And then all the way down to the Keno Dam. And then anything below the Keno Dam on the Oregon side that's of issue?
No.
Okay.
Not at this time.
All right. So then that brings it into your country, Susan Fricke. So is there anything upstream from the, let's see, it's Copco, Iron Rose, I can't remember the order of the dams off the top of my head at the moment, but are there any stretches of the river in California that are not under advisory at the moment?
I'm actually not familiar with the data that we're collecting right up above the reservoirs. But what does happen is when you get into the reservoirs, you get these very, very high levels of the blooms. That the reservoirs are creating this ideal habitat for the toxic algae, and they love these warm, nutrient-rich bathtubs, and that's what these reservoirs are creating. And then the algae is discharged into the river below. So we have a pretty nasty condition for toxic algae blooms on the river.
Craig Tucker, are there any things that people can do if, as you point out, people feel like they do need to be in touch with the river in some way? I mean, if they can just sort of screen the scum off the top of the water, does that provide any level of safety or security?
Well, you can definitely identify places, either the river or in the reservoirs, where the algae scums tend to accumulate. Sometimes they're blown by the wind. But it's not just the algae that's the problem. The algae actually secretes this toxin, and this toxin's water-soluble. It's invisible. And so you don't, just because you're avoiding an algae scum does not mean you're avoiding exposure to the toxin itself. So really, when these water bodies are posted, you really should avoid all contact with the water body.
And Susan Fricke, you had mentioned that there are concerns here about fish caught in the river as well. I mean, what normally can happen if people are catching fish out of an area where there is a blue-green algae warning, and what's the current situation now?
Well, when the levels are lower and there's just a warning, what we recommend is that they just remove the skin, you remove the organs of the fish, because, again, like Craig said, this is a liver toxin, so the parts of the body that the toxin bioaccumulate into is generally your organs like your liver. However, when you get really high levels, For the state of California, they recommend that when levels are over 20 micrograms per liter, which we do have a spot in the Klamath River that are doing that, and the reservoirs Copco and Iron Gate are exceeding those levels, they recommend not eating the fish at all because you can get enough of the toxin in that we've also found that it starts accumulating within the tissue of the fish too.
All right, so don't eat the fish at all when you're above 20 micrograms per liter. What are the normal, is there a level below which there's no advisory at all? I mean, is there some of this level that can be present in the water without any particular danger to people?
Correct. There are erg levels, and it's different. Rebecca can talk about for Oregon. For California, we actually have a tiered warning system where we have a caution level at 0.8 micrograms per liter, which is just an advisory to people like, there's something in the water that you should be cautious about. Maybe don't let the dogs and the kids get in there because they are your higher risk categories. And then at 6 micrograms per liter, they start to restrict contact with the water, and, you know, you need to wash the fish and things like that. And then at above 20 micrograms per liter, that's when you're at your danger level, and that's when you shouldn't be eating any fish out of the water bodies. You shouldn't have any contact with the water bodies. So that's really how we've been working on it in California.
Rebecca Hillwig in Oregon, are there similar levels of warning in on the Oregon side?
Yeah, we don't use a tiered approach like California does. We do have guideline values right now that are in place, that have been in place for some time. And for microcystin, for this summer, it's 10 parts per billion. So anything that's at 10 or above would trigger an advisory. Anything lower than that for microcystin would not. However, this coming summer, 2018, we will be adopting the EPA guideline values for microcystin would be 4 instead of 10. So it is going to decrease by quite a bit, but still above some of California's levels.
All right. So if you're adopting the EPA values, does that mean there'll be potentially more warnings next summer, in the summer of 2018, just given that the level of action has lowered?
That's correct.
Okay. We're talking to Rebecca Hillwig at the Oregon Health Authority about the harmful algae blooms, which are present right now in the Klamath River very extensively on both sides of the state line. Susan Fricke is the Karuk Tribe's water quality coordinator. Craig Tucker, the biologist for the Karuk Tribe. 800-838-3760 if you'd like to get into this conversation. Emails go to jx@jeffnet.org. Craig Tucker, does boiling the water do anything to remove any issues for people? I mean, and given the fact that there are some communities that do take water out of the Klamath River for drinking water supply, is this an issue?
Well, it can be an issue, and you boil the water to kill some kind of bacterial pathogen or parasite. And because this toxin is a cyclic protein, it's a pretty stable molecule, and so boiling the water doesn't effectively address the toxicity issue. So that's really not a solution here. And for folks who are interested in fishing or recreating on the Klamath, there is a place you can go to find out which reaches of the river are listed, and it's the Klamath Basin Monitoring Program's website. And they actually have what they call the blue-green algae tracker. So you can go to that website, and there's a map, and it's color-coded, and some reaches of the river are color-coded red or yellow or green. And that website is KBMP. Which stands for Klamath Basin Monitoring Program, .net. And so there is a place folks can go and get more information and know if the reach of river in their backyard is one of the reaches of the river that's listed.
KBMP.net, and we'll make sure that we are linked to that from our discussion about this at the Jefferson Exchange page, jeffexchange.org. Are there particular factors this year, Craig Tucker, that make this as severe as it is?
Well, it was interesting to me because in the past, it seemed like we've had the worst blooms in years where there was a very dry winter and a very hot summer. So you had low flows of water. You had warm water gets impounded behind these dams, and you have these massive blooms. And this year is different because we had a really wet winter. So talking to Susan and other water quality experts, it sounds like because we had several years of drought, that left a lot of the nutrients on the landscape. And so then when we had this really wet winter, it basically flushed all these nutrients into the water bodies. And so I think, as climatologists warn us, that one of the realities is global warming is these sort of swings to weather extremes from severe drought to severe wet weather, we're seeing ecosystems react this way. So I just think we're a little outside of what we would consider the norm for the several hundred years that we've got the kind of data that we look at for these things. And one of the ways this is manifesting in the climate is having severe algae blooms in years we maybe wouldn't expect it.
Rebecca Hellwig, let's talk about Oregon more generally, because you're looking at the whole state here. This is an issue for the Klamath Basin on the Oregon side, certainly, and on the California side as well. But what are you seeing around Oregon? How has this year been generally, given the set of climatic conditions we've faced?
Yeah, for Oregon, it's a little bit harder to sort of, do trending, just because it is a voluntary program, and so we rely on other agencies and groups to actually do monitoring of blooms that might be identified in a water body. And so we get sort of sporadic data throughout the season, which is, again, a little difficult to trend. However, I am seeing, both in the data and anecdotally, that there are definitely more blooms around the state, and that they are forming earlier and lasting longer. We have the same problem that was just talked about, in that, these severe droughts and then rain actually just wash nutrients into the water bodies, and that's enough nutrification to give food for these little cyanobacteria to actually form into what we call a bloom, which is a big colony of these little bacteria. So definitely finding that it is getting worse.
So just quickly, about a minute left here. What should people be doing with the Klamath River water on the Oregon side, where the advisories are in place?
Well, we recommend the same thing, that, ingestion is the major route of exposure. And so, any contact with the water where you might be ingesting, especially with children and pets who are at greatest risk, just to stay out of the water and is the most, is the best precaution.
All right. Warnings in place for the blue-green algae on both sides of the state line. Rebecca Hellwig is with the Harmful Algal Bloom Surveillance Program at the Oregon Health Authority. Susan Fricke, the Water Quality Coordinator for the Karuk Tribe. Craig Tucker, Biologist for the Karuk Tribe. Thank you all for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having us.
All right. Take care. One more water quality story I want to bring into your attention before we get out of this segment, which is that scientists predict that plastic in the ocean will eventually outweigh fish in the ocean. But how many of these plastics are ending up in our seafood, and where are they coming from? In the Pacific Northwest, new research is helping to answer those questions. Ken Christensen with our EarthFix team has the story.
Sarah Dudas is happy to shuck an oyster or a clam in the name of science.
This one's not as easy as the others. There we go.
Just don't ask her to eat one.
I associate a bucket of clams with work, not dinner. I'm inside, look, oh wow, that one's really fertile. I can see all the eggs in it. These are comments I make at dinner parties.
She's a shellfish biologist at Vancouver Island University. And lately, she's making other unappetizing observations about plastics in those shellfish. Last summer, she and her students collected thousands of clams and oysters. They added chemicals to break the shellfish down, filtered the biodegradable stuff through fine mesh, and put what was left behind under a microscope.
We're finding most shellfish have plastic in them.
So when you eat clams and oysters,
you're eating plastic as well.
Her study was funded by the Canadian government and British Columbia's shellfish industry. They wanted to know whether shellfish farmers are contaminating their own crop.
Shellfish aquaculture uses a lot of plastic infrastructure. It's one of the tricky things, is really trying to figure out the sources of the plastics.
So she turned to Peter Ross. He studies ocean pollution at the Vancouver Aquarium. He had already been searching for microplastics in water samples off the Pacific Northwest coast.
We were floored. We documented large numbers, all the way up to 9,200 particles per cubic meter of seawater.
9,200 particles per cubic meter. That's like emptying a salt shaker into a large moving box. Some of the pieces were tiny broken fragments, or little kernels of styrofoam. Some were microbeads used in toothpaste and face wash. But most of them were similar to the ones Dudas is finding, They're like colorful microscopic hairs.
80% of the particles of microplastics that we're running into consist of fibers. We see loads and loads of fibers.
Ross is trying to figure out where those fibers are coming from, turning his science lab into something more like a crime lab. He places one of the particles in a forensic machine.
We're trying to identify what this mystery particle is. We're just going to pinch that down there so there's direct contact.
It analyzes the particle and generates a jagged line on a nearby computer. That's the plastic's unique infrared signature. Then it cross-references that line with similar graphs from a global database.
You know, 1, 2, 3 beautiful peaks.
Ross and a lab assistant run down the list of possible matches. Fibers with names like Wonder Thread.
Nylon.
So this is kind of nice because they're all nylon, right?
Exactly.
They've also identified synthetics like olefin and polyester. Ross says the data is adding to a growing body of evidence that a big source of this pollution is clothing. A single load of laundry can shed thousands of synthetic microfibers from garments like fleeces and sweaters. Those fibers can get flushed into the ocean because filters on washing machines and wastewater treatment plants aren't built to catch particles that small. Jeff Crook is the chief product officer at Mountain Equipment Co-op, one of Canada's biggest outdoor retailers. He says Ross's research is crucial to make changes in the industry.
That's part of what we're looking to the science for. And the more we know about how this problem's manifesting in the water, the more we can go back and tinker and try to improve the materials.
Better materials may be one way to keep these fibers out of the food chain. But should we be concerned about being a part of that food chain? Biologist Sarah Dudas says scientists aren't sure yet.
Literally every day we're learning more about the risk that those microplastics might pose to the animals that are eating them, us included as well.
But she knows one thing. If we don't change the way we consume plastic in society, we can plan on consuming more of it at the dinner table. In Vancouver, British Columbia, I'm Ken Christensen.